This is the Education Gadfly Show.
By the way, Friedman, on a topic that is not school choice.
That's very true.
I know. Did they find a way to conclude that the answer is vouchers?
One of the recommendations was you could give more vouchers with this money that we saved.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a woman who loves teachers even more than President Obama and Mitt Romney, Kathleen Porter-McGee.
We all love teachers, don't we?
We love teachers, but you know what? They don't love Mitt Romney back, according to the NEA. They did a mock Valentine, I guess, to tease him about his statement that he loves teachers.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes. Everybody loves teachers. And that is our official policy here at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and the Education Gadfly Show. We love teachers, except for the bad ones, and we hate them and want them fired. Okay.
Nice.
Lots to cover. It is election time, and that means that there's education in the news. Ty, let's start with you. Pardon the gadfly.
Is it significant that both candidates keep wanting to talk about education during the debates?
Kathleen, this is hilarious. I mean, I don't think there was a single question on education in any of the debates, right? And yet, every single time in each single debate, they talked about education extensively. So what's going on? Is it just some issue that polls well? Why do they keep wanting to talk about education?
Yeah, I mean, I think education definitely polls well, and I think that's why they both want to talk about it. But I also think they actually both feel like they have something to say, so they want to highlight the details of their reform plans, and so they're eager to get it out whenever they can.
Yeah, and you know, as you can see from the president's perspective, who in a lot of cases doesn't have a great record to run on, he can point to having accomplished quite a bit in education, and it's also things that sound that are centrist, that are maybe not traditional for a Democrat. For Mitt Romney, he can talk about Massachusetts as being a governor. Everybody likes to hear, oh, that guy was a governor, he ran something, and his education system was pretty good. And by the way, for Republicans, it's especially important to talk about education because, you know, a lot of perceptions out there that Republicans just don't care about education. So that this makes some sense. But, you know, they kept trying to make this point that, you know, the key to foreign policy and national security is education. The key to better jobs, education. The key to poverty, education. I mean, are we putting too much on education or are we all in the right field? Because yes, indeed, education is the key to all of this.
I mean, I think on some level it's the key to everything, but I think that we can overstate that. And you can understand why teachers feel like they have the weight of the world on top of them when everybody says everything comes down to education. Obviously, there are more things to talk about in foreign policy than just education.
Yes. Okay. Topic number two, Ty.
With the election looming, what do you see as top state-level education issues on ballots?
All right, Kathleen. So we've got a couple of options out there, right? In Georgia, there's an initiative that would recreate a statewide charter school authorizer that got wiped out by a decision of their state Supreme Court. You've got in Idaho a whole suite of school reforms, including some reforms to collective bargaining, teacher eval, tenure. The unions are trying to take that out with an initiative. You've got the initiative in Washington State to create charter schools finally in that outpost. So what do you think? And any of these or others that you think are more significant?
I mean, God, it's a tough question, right? I mean, I think what's interesting and what's significant is that there is so much education reform on state agendas. There's so much happening right now. And it seems to me that that is the most significant thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously, charters is playing. I mean, that's a big issue right now. But I don't know that it's possible to say this is the single most significant one, but rather that education reform writ large. Yeah.
And according, I understand from, I think I saw this from the National Council of State Legislators, maybe that there are more education issues on the ballot this year than ever before. Mm-hmm. Now, if I had to vote, I would say Idaho is probably the most important one, although it's probably the one that reformers are most likely to lose. The unions are investing heavily there, and at least from the press accounts, it doesn't sound like there's anybody investing on the other side, perhaps, because most of these school reform groups that invest in races like this are Democratic-leaning, and you've got Republicans out front on this issue. People are calling these laws that got passed in Idaho the Luna laws after Tom Luna, the state superintendent. He has taken so much flack for really doing things that other governors have done that we've celebrated, going after tenure, pushing teacher valuations, that sort of thing. But they might take it out. There are some hopes, I think, that we might finally see the charter school bill initiative pass in Washington State. The unions are not fighting that very hard. And so who knows? Finally, Seattle might have a few charter schools. Amazing. Okay, tie, topic number three.
100 archdioceses are among the private school systems that have now adopted the Common Core. What does this mean for Catholic education and the standards movement?
So I think this is actually an interesting question. It's newsworthy that they're adopting the Common Core, but this is not the first time that Catholic schools have adopted standards. Standards-driven education and instruction has existed in Catholic schools before the Common Core. I know there were a handful of archdioceses that had actually adopted, for example, the Indiana standards before the Common Core, and they were working together because obviously there's economies of scale just for the Catholic schools, just like there is for the public schools. So I think that the fact that they're adopting the Common Core means that they understand and appreciate the importance of standards in driving instruction, mm-hmm. and that they want to rightly capitalize on the economies of scale that are going to exist. I mean, people are going to be updating curriculum resources. There's going to be a lot of free materials. Why not take advantage of that?
Kathleen, how do you think this is going to play? I mean, from the perspective, look, we support the Common Core. This seems like another great example that, hey, these must be good standards. The Catholics, archdioceses are adopting them. But you can imagine opponents saying, see, these standards that are, you know, due in some part to federal coercion are now even infecting the private school market.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, people can spin this one way or another. I think that the Catholic schools really have an opportunity to show, because they really have complete freedom, and they can implement them however makes the most sense. And mm-hmm. so I think they have an opportunity to show, first of all, that these standards don't need to be a straitjacket, mm-hmm. and second of all, to show how they can really be very thoughtfully implemented. So I hope they take this leadership.
Do you think federal coercion was behind this decision, Kathleen?
Yeah, no. I don't think the archbishops are known for their capitulation to federal coercion.
Right, then at least it's a papal conspiracy.
Right, obviously.
All right, that's all the time we got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Ty. Thanks, Kathleen. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Hello, Amber.
Hi, Mike.
So, Amber, you are kind of like our correspondent who's in touch with the teachers out there, all your teacher friends. So when the candidates said that they love teachers the other day, is their love back to those candidates as far as you can tell?
I think the teachers needed to hear that. Yeah. Yes, I think we all know teachers feel like they're being beat up. So, yeah. Can't give enough love to the teachers.
But they feel that. They're not cynical about it. I mean, so many, like the NEA is cynical about it. Clearly, they're going to send a fake Valentine to Romney. But yeah. I mean, I hope teachers feel like there is a lot of respect out there for teachers.
I don't really think they do.
They don't feel
that. No, I don't think so.
But what about when they hear Mitt Romney?
Right,
but they hear Barack Obama and Mitt Romney saying we love teachers. Does that make them feel a little better?
I just think like they chalk it up to politics. Yeah.
We're all cynics now.
Yeah, we're all cynics.
All right. Okay, well, what you got for us this week?
We got a new Friedman Foundation report. It examines the growth in school staffing over the last 20 to 50 years. So they looked at all public school personnel, teachers, and non-teaching personnel in particular. They find that between 1950 and 2009, the number of K-12 public school students increased by 96%, while the number of full-time school employees grew by 386%.
Wow.
Public schools grew staffing at a rate four times faster than the increase in students over the same time period. Of those personnel, teacher numbers increased by 252%. Administrators and other staff grew by, 702%.
Wow.
More than seven times the increase in students. Then when we look just at 1992 to 2009, K-12 students nationwide grew by about 17%. Full-time school employees by 39%, so that's about 2.3 times greater than the increase in students. Then they looked at the states, so 48 states upped the number of non-teaching personnel at a faster rate than their increase in students. And even when student populations were dropping, public school systems were increasing staffing between 92 to 2009. Mm-hmm. Nine states in particular had declining enrollments, but yet significant increases in staffing. So Maine gets the booby prize here. From 1992 to 2009, they lost roughly 11% mm-hmm. of their students, yet they had a 76% increase in the number of non-teaching personnel. Similar patterns in our backyard here in DC, also in Wyoming and North Dakota. Hawaii saw an increase of students about 3%. its non-teaching staff grew at a rate 25 times greater than that.
Wow.
Finally, last bit, little tidbit. They do a back-of-the-envelope calculation. They say, you know what? If non-teaching personnel had grown during those 2009 years, about 18 years, at the same rate as the growth in students, and if the teaching force had only grown 1.5 times faster, so they gave them a little leeway, American public schools would have an additional $37.2 billion to spend per year. And then they say all these things we could have done with that money.
Wow. Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit. First of all, you're talking a lot about non-teaching personnel. So this mm-hmm. is not just a matter of lowering class sizes.
Right.
Okay. I mean, that shows up in the teacher numbers. That did happen. That is part of it, but that's not all of it. It's right. These other people. Who are these other people that they fired?
So they don't... We actually are going to do that in a similar report where we actually say who these people are, and we say, okay, some of them are librarians, media staff, some are parapros, but in this report, they actually did not disaggregate that category.
And then the next question is this just special education? And people say, look, this is what, you know, starting in 1975, suddenly we, you know, trying to mainstream special ed kids, and so we hired a bunch of aides and other staff and therapists, specialists to try to help those. Is that explained at all?
Yeah, not in this report. Okay. I think that's a reasonable hypothesis. It's one that data are really hard to get a handle on from having done our own special ed report. We had a difficult time wrapping our head around that. It's a plausible theory that some of these numbers are being driven by the special ed.
Although some of this is in the last 18 years, so that would be after that big change. I mean, you'd expect to see a big bump in the 70s and 80s, let's say, as people got, as we mainstream kids for the first time. But, you know, it should be fairly steady, you'd think, since the 90s or so.
Right. Yeah. And then this is an interesting discussion. They get into, are kids harder to teach than they were back then, you know, and he brings up a lot of research by Carolyn Hoxby and others where she says, you know, on some indicators are actually easier to teach. They have fewer siblings, which is one of those things. Parental income is higher. Mm-hmm. I think that could be argued either way.
Kathleen, when you were at Achievement First, did you guys have a lot of these non-teaching staff around specialists, aides, parapros, those sorts of people?
No, but we did in our elementary schools. We had two full classroom teachers in each classroom.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, exactly. So we actually didn't have paras, but we had extra teachers.
Wow.
So we had bigger classrooms than the neighboring schools, but we had two teachers, which allowed them to target instruction in small groups in really effective ways. So they probably actually had fewer staff, but they harnessed that staff, I think, in a really smart way.
So these were similarly certified teachers?
They were fully teachers.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, often it would be when they'd bring in an inexperienced teacher, they'd pair them with a more experienced teacher in the same, so they take their least experienced teachers and pair them with their best teachers. So you had kind of a de facto mentoring program going on. It was interesting. It was actually a really...
And are they grouped? The kids are grouped by their ability levels? Was that the idea?
So
tailor instruction?
No, but you could actually then break the group up. So for example, during your reading time, you could have three groups of, you know, three groups of 7 to 9 students. Mm-hmm. And you could group them by abilities so that you could target interventions, and you can target reading instruction at a really individualized level.
This is a really important area, though, for us to keep looking into. We knew from our study that came out in August by Nate Levinson on special education that some districts get by with very few specialists and paraprofessionals on special ed, and others hire a ton of these people.
Right.
And you get these aides that are, you know, have a high school diploma and follow a special ed kid around all day and may not be helping those kids very much because they can't do much instruction.
What are they doing? That's why I asked you, like, what are they doing? So, I mean, that's different, right? If they're really working with kids by ability levels or doing small groups, it's different than, I'm sitting beside my child who's got special needs and, you know, helping them with problem 2 on the worksheet or whatever. You know what I mean? I don't know. I just think it looks different in terms of how you service those kids.
All right. Well, kudos to the Friedman Foundation for bringing up this issue. By the way, Friedman on a topic that is not school choice.
That's very true.
I know. Did they find a way to conclude that the answer is vouchers?
One of the recommendations was you could give more vouchers with this money that we save.
Yes. All right. That's good. Whew. I just want to make sure the world is still spinning on its axis.
Crazy.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Thanks. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Till next week.
I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.